This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
When Meghan Markle met the Queen of England, did she go, "Yas, Queen"? Is that where it all started to go downhill? From Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kundabolu, and I can say the alphabet backwards in under 5 seconds. Come on, you want to hear it?
He's been so excited to
come
do
on,
this.
You want to hear it, right? It's good. You've never heard me do this.
Yeah, fine, okay. Do it.
ZYXWVUTSRQPONMLKJHGVDCBA.
Feel better now?
Yeah.
We're two friends and stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
Last week, we talked about the Atlanta spa killings with Dr. Connie Won. We talked about how the criminal justice system makes sex workers and people who are perceived as sex workers more vulnerable.
This week, we'll hear from one of the leading voices in the movement to decriminalize sex work, Lala Holston Zanell.
Because I am a black trans woman, and I'm a black trans woman and a sex worker, to the rest of the world, my life ain't shh. My community is hurting, and I wear that on my shoulders, and I'm trying to get people to understand.
Lala is trans justice campaign manager for the ACLU and discusses the costs of making sex work a crime.
Then we spent some time with Alana Glazer, who with Abby Jacobson created and starred in the hit Comedy Central series Broad City.
In 2020, Alana mobilized young voters through her Horny for the Polls tour and her web series Cheat Sheet for the Voting Booth.
There is such a high barrier of entry to understanding politics. I really feel like you have to grow up in D.C. with parents who are politicians to have a baseline structural understanding of what policy is and how it gets made.
She's got a new movie coming out on Hulu called False Positive. It's a horror thriller about fertility treatment, of course. And coincidentally, she just announced she's pregnant.
We also talked to Alana about going to high school on Long Island and cultural appropriation in Broad City, particularly her use of the phrase Yas Queen.
Then we see it on TV and we're like, yeah, that's incorrect. That's incorrect. And then we're like, well, it's funny that it's incorrect because we're fucking white knuckleheads.
Is that right? Yas Queen? Yas Queen!
You sound like a robot who's been programmed to say it.
Yas Queen.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
You go, girl.
Hey, what's up, Hurry?
Nothing, Kamau. You know, great week in the news. It's good. We had a light week. Can't think of anything terrible that happened. Also, I've been watching a kid, so I haven't been following the news.
Awful thing is, like, there's literally three or four things you could be talking about when you're sort of making the nothing big happen in the news. I mean, there's many, you know, everybody can have a different thing about, like, yeah, that was an awful thing that happened. But yes.
Right.
Yes, as we released the episode last week, the mass shooting happened in Boulder, Colorado, which was right off the back of the mass shooting that happened in Atlanta. You know, and I think there was a little bit, we all had this illusion that during the pandemic that we were done with mass shootings. And there were people definitely got shot during the pandemic. There were things that could have been qualified as mass shootings. But this type of mass shooting we hadn't seen in a while or hadn't talked about. And so we had to have two back to back. And, you know, Biden ran on, one of the things he ran on was gun controls. And so now's the time. And this week, apparently, Biden's doing infrastructure week, so maybe next week we can get to gun control.
That seems like a thing that gets pushed constantly. Maybe we can push it again.
Literally, Trump had infrastructure week several times, and he kept pushing it himself because he kept getting distracted by other things. So, yeah, we've pushed infrastructure week before. Infrastructure is super important. Also, I think we're capable of more than one thing at once.
And also, if there's a gunman in the house, that isn't the time to be like, we need to replace the roof. Not the time. You know what I mean? Can you come over? We have a gunman in the house right now, but I really got to get this leak patched up. I got to get this roof patched up. I know it's not a great time, but I figure, you know, why don't we do both? It's just weird because it's like, it's always the right time. The idea of like, we have momentum. Now, we've had momentum for a long time.
And we've had all the same conversations, even the retorts to the same conversations. Like, you know, Republicans tweeting out, now's not the time to talk about it. And people go, well, when is the time to talk about it? Like, we've had all the same things. We've sort of gone through all the same
I don't even tweet about it anymore, Kamal. I just retweet the old ones. I just retweet the things I've said, because there's nothing else to say. Oh, yeah, this is the thing I said about Sandy Hook 8 years ago. This is the thing I said. It's all the same. There's no new discussion points. After you murder tons of children, there's nothing else new.
There's some real fundamental ways in which this country is absolutely broken that has been revealed throughout the pandemic and revealed over and over again. Where at the same time, the trial of the Derek Chauvin, the officer who murdered George Floyd, is happening right now. A fundamental way in which the country is broken. The rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, a fundamental way in which the country is broken. And then just regular old American capitalism, which has made billionaires richer and made everybody else poor, a fundamental way in which the country is broken. And, you know, as a person who sort of like sits in this space, sort of studying this stuff, I'm fucking exhausted. Like, I really am like, it's just everywhere you look, it is just another reminder of how broken this country is and how much... Nobody's going, hold on, wait a minute. We got to fix this before we go forward. There's no hold on, wait a minute for this. So gun control people are losing sort of like faith in Joe Biden already. And I don't blame them. I don't blame them at all. But it's like, man, it's such a huge bummer. And then it also reveals these other fractures that happen, like the sort of the debate around the race of the guy, the shooter in Boulder.
Everybody assumed he was white. I mean, that's what Twitter showed me. Immediately the tweets about like, you know, a white shooter. Like, you know, I've taken part in this. It's like...
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's like another white, angry white dude shooting some... When is this going to stop? And like, you know, what is the race and religion of the... You know, they didn't say, so he's probably white. Like, you know the kind of...
Yeah, a lot of people tweeted out the fact that they were... And even after you saw the picture, it's like a guy with a beard, with white-looking skin, with his shirt off. You're like, oh, it's a white guy.
It's a white guy. And then it gets real. He has a Muslim name, right? And I don't know more than that. Yeah. Maybe he's Muslim. Maybe he's culturally Muslim. But then what happens after? Then you have the like, see, he was a Muslim. So then that side of it goes in. Now this reinforces the fact Muslims are against. And so that you have that part of it. And then what frustrates me, and I think to me the most heartbreaking, like PS on something that's already heartbreaking, is then the Muslim community in Boulder, Colorado has to come out and disown this guy and raise money for the victims, which is a very good thing to do. But they might do it anyway. Absolutely. But part of it, it's just the same thing. Like after 9/11, like there's a lot of like brown people putting American flags on their windows. And so, like my mom did that. You know, part of it is like, you know, I feel for the country and I'm an American. The other part is don't throw a rock through here. So you're seeing that again. And that is heartbreaking. It's like, God damn it. White people don't have to do that every time. Every time something happens and someone vaguely connected to their community or with a name that somehow triggers, this stranger doesn't represent who I am. Of course he fucking doesn't. I just hate having to see that every time.
To put on my nerd glasses, technically he is white. If we're talking about how race works in this country, how it works on the census, Arab Americans, the Arab diaspora, people in this country worked hard to get a category in the census for MENA, Middle East North African. Because currently on the census, if you're of a person from that descent, then you just are filed under white, which of course makes zero sense. Maybe ever, but specifically in a post 9/11 world that you would just be like, yep, white from Syria here. But that Trump and his people worked hard to not get that category put on there. Who knows for what reason? You'd think they'd want those people not counted their white purity. Yeah. But also, let's be clear, white people need the numbers in this country.
Exactly. They want the numbers on the forms, but, you know, which actually doesn't make sense to me, too, because you would think they'd want the numbers to go down to push their whole agenda of, like, we're losing the war.
None of it makes sense. A Syrian immigrant on the census is a white person. I'm not... Do with that what you will. That's just when I saw people like going, see, he's white. He's not white. He's Syrian. I was like, technically, if you look at the census, that's what, I mean, he can check whatever he wants on the census because anybody can. He could put some other race. But it just is, again, another way in which this country is fundamentally broken. broken the way that which we're arguing about the race of a mass shooter, and we're also not even getting it right because this country's right. racial categorizations make zero sense.
If he said his name was Mike Johnson, he'd mm-hmm. be a white guy. But yeah. his name browned him yeah. up.
His name. Well, that happens. That'll happen to you. Literally, it doesn't make any sense at all. And yet it's a system through which we live in, and only we have to deal with it because there actually are real world consequences to this nonsense system. The beat goes on. Last week, we got a lot of good feedback about our episode, our super packed episode featuring Trey Strangio from the ACLU talking about trans rights and trans kids and sports.
Yep.
And we had Dr. Connie Wun, my old friend from back in the day, talking about anti-Asian hate crimes and specifically Atlanta, and a lot of people. I saw a lot of that stuff getting shared in ways I don't often see, so I was happy to that. And also my only child friend, Derek Delgadio. He was also in the episode. And he got cast in as he's in a Steven Soderbergh film. So his appearance on our show really did a lot for him. So
jeez. It's done more for him than for me.
We got a packed episode, not quite as packed as last week.
We're talking to Alana Glazer, who some of you might know from being famous. I think that's one reason. Also, she co-created and co-starred in Broad City with Abby Jacobson, a show that my brother Ashok and I did punch-up work on during the second season, which means after the scripts are written, she picks a few talented comedians to write jokes to add on to make it even funnier. And if you like the second season more than the other seasons, that's why.
Wow.
We talked to Alana about a lot of things, including the work she did in 2020 to mobilize and educate young voters.
Before we get to that, we're going to, in some part, follow up on the conversation we had with Dr. Connie Wun last week. If you missed it, again, check it out. A lot of the young folks were sharing it on the socials. Dr. Connie talked about the spa killings outside of Atlanta from a number of angles, one being the way our criminal justice system actually increases the chances of sex workers being abused and victimized. And Hari, you had some thoughts on that?
You know, I just want to make the point, we don't actually know that the women that were murdered, the people that were murdered were sex workers, right? And I think there's a lot of implication of that. If they were murdered because it was assumed they were sex workers, I think obviously that should be spoken about. You know, I think about it in terms of, you know, Sikhs who were murdered because the assumption was that they were Muslim post 9/11. Like, we don't want Sikhs or Muslims to be murdered. And the same thing is true. We don't want people who are sex workers or not sex workers or assumed to be sex workers murdered. And secondly, let's say they were sex workers. They might not be out about being sex workers. It might be something that they had to do or chose to do, but that's not something they necessarily wanted to share with the outside world. So there is a sensitivity I feel like I haven't seen amongst the media when talking about this. To clarify, there is nothing wrong with being a sex worker, but people should have the choice to identify themselves in whatever way they choose. And I don't think that the people who were murdered really got that option.
Connie addressed that, but as you're right, we can't get clear enough on that because we keep having conversations headed in the wrong direction around all these things. And this is certainly where Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw's idea of intersectionality comes into place, as far as like women, a bunch of identities that maybe these women are holding or maybe they're not holding, but we have to be able to have nuanced conversations about it. This week, we're actually going to talk to one of the leading voices in the movement to decriminalize sex work, Lala Holston-Zanell, trans justice campaign manager for an organization I like to call the ACLU.
We had a fantastic conversation, and I think it's safe to say, Kamau, we made a new friend.
Yes, because we were told we did. Lala Holston-Zanell is the trans justice campaign manager for the ACLU.
She leads the ACLU's advocacy and organizing work to support and empower transgender and non-binary people.
It was Lala's advocacy that led the ACLU to make decriminalizing sex work one of its policy priorities.
It's a great conversation. Let's talk to Lala. Lala, thank you so much for being on Politically Reactive today. It's an honor for you to It's an honor for us to have you with us. It's an honor for you to be here. And
wow. Ooh. So,
that's the most confidence I've ever had.
It's an honor. Thank you for being here.
You're
very honored. You're very honored. I don't know if you're aware.
I mean, thank you, but now I'm nervous. Like, what did they tell you about me? Why are you so nervous? We're just going to have a conversation amongst friends, I thought.
You have a wealth of knowledge on this that, like, so many of us don't have. And especially in, you know, progressive circles, for whatever that means, like, this is one of the blind spots, right? And, you know, it's wonderful that you're pushing the ACLU to, and have pushed the ACLU to support a decriminalization of sex work.
Thank you. I'm excited to really talk about it in a real way. I think the problem with this discussion is it's a table talk conversation. Everyone participates in it, but no one wants to be honest and talk about it.
There you go.
So I just offer that if we had this conversation, that you allow yourself to fully have this conversation. Let those judgments go. Let anything what people have told you about sex work, let that go out of your mind. Let's set some intentions for this conversation. So if y'all can enter the conversation like that, I'm down to have a conversation.
Oh,
let's go.
I mean, the thing that we wanted to start with is to start with defining some terms.
Okay.
So can you define sex work for us?
So sex work is any type of work where folks are engaging in adult services for pay. So massage therapists, people who are in the porn industry, strippers, people who are escorts, people who are fetish workers and BDSM workers, things of that nature, which are being compensated for their services, which I feel is just community healing work. That is what sexual work is. It is healing. And I think at first, before we talk about what decriminalized sex work is or what sex work is, we have to be comfortable to talk about sex. A lot of us quick to have sex, but not comfortable talking about sex publicly. And so that's where the problem is, because a lot of us have shame behind it. Depending on who you are, what you look like, what race you are, what is your expression. And so that's the beginning of it. It's an uncomfortableness around talking about sex as a whole.
I mean, it's interesting because particularly with, before I get there, because I'm also struggling.
Don't be nervous, Hurry. Don't be nervous.
It's not nervousness. It's like struggling with terms because I was about to use the word prostitution. Like, when people talk about prostitution, they say it's the oldest profession, yet people don't acknowledge it as work, right?
That is true.
But as I was thinking about asking that question, I got uncomfortable by the term prostitution. So I was
going
to ask...
That is what I was going to say. And that's why I didn't use that term. And I use other terms because there's that stigma and shame. And so something that everyone is resisting, everyone participates. We don't talk about that. Everyone participates in it in one way or the other. Yeah. But at the same time, you want to police it. So you have to shame it by giving it a name, calling it prostitution.
Right.
It's not prostitution. White supremacy created that to shame you and make everyone think, again, putting more things in your head that is wrong. But we all, again, participate in it in one way or other.
So instead of prostitution or prostitute, it should be sex worker and sex work.
Yeah, sex worker, sex work, or ask the person what they want to be called. A lot of people in our community call themselves sexual healers. You know, and so it depends on asking the person, but using those stigmas and shames, those words we don't want to use.
What is the sex trade?
Sex trade is basically kind of the same thing where you're trading certain favors for compensation or other things.
And survival work?
You're doing it because you have to survive. Like if you can get a job and you can do everything else and have access like every American is supposed to be, you probably wouldn't be on that end of the world.
Right.
But because you have to survive and we all have to eat, that's what you have chosen to do, to eat. So it's survival for you. It's not, you know, something that you really wanted to do.
I guess finally, trafficking.
Trafficking. That is someone who is taking someone and making someone do sex and then they're not getting paid for that. You are legally taking someone. Someone who's most likely minors, trafficking lots of people without consent. There's no consent. And we are not, I am totally against that. Anyone doing something unconsented.
I mean, I think one of the things that you've pointed to as you've patiently let Hurry throw all these words at you.
I'm getting tongue twisted too.
That's all right. No, it's a lot. is there's also this thing where there's just a constant sort of evolution of the words and the ways in which it's described, which I think is another ways in which some people feel like, I'm going to just stay out of this, even if they should be involved in it. Like, you know, progressive folks or people who want to say the right thing. They may say, like you just said, that word, the P word. I'm just going to say the P word. And somebody goes, that's not the right word. And they go, you know what? This is too much trouble. I'm going to just stay out of this. And so yes. I think people get, don't you think people get, and I believe in the evolution of terms. Let me be clear about that. But people get caught up in the fear about like saying the wrong thing.
If you live in that fear of saying the wrong thing, you will always live in fear.
Yeah.
There are always moments in my life where I fear I'm going to say the wrong thing. That's just what it is, a part of life. But also we can get to engage on how we want to engage in that. If you're not sure, you can ask. Then the fear is left off of you because you've asked. The not asking is the problem.
I have friends who, broadly speaking, are sex workers, and some of them would not want to be called sex workers. And I guess, again, that speaks to the idea of you ask questions. And I guess it also speaks to the idea it's okay to have friends who are sex workers.
Of course.
And you should be able to communicate with all people, and it's not something that should be taboo. And I think a lot more people have friends who are sex workers than they want to admit or are willing to see, but this is all part of it.
And can we talk about the idea? Because I think the other part that is obviously people get hung up on is the idea of legalization of sex work versus decriminalization, and why those two differences are important.
Decriminalizing it is going to like decrease some of the harm that happens, take away some of those horrible convictions that folks can get, versus full decriminalizing it, meaning that no one would be getting in trouble for it, whether you are a purchaser of sex or if you are selling sex. Meaning it would just be legally okay to do that in the same ways they have legalized weed, in the same ways they have legalized other things. It would be nothing else but legalizing the sex trade.
So decriminalization means that it's not legal, but there's no punishment.
Yes, correct.
And is that better than just legalization, or is it, what's the difference, I guess?
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I of course would want, you know, full decrim. That's the goal, you know, but are we ready yet? Like I said, are we really ready to have that conversation? I think that we would have more of a long way of decriminalizing it more. I think there's a lot like walking while trans bans, stuff like that, where folks are being policed by just their identities and getting locked up for that. That just got repealed in New York. So just things are making a state where people want to be able to be comfortable to report to police if something happens. I would take decriminalization, but of course the goal is full decrim. I just don't think that we're ready there yet, because I don't think everyone's ready to have that real conversation.
Why was it so important you to push for decriminalization? And also, how does it connect to the trans justice work that you do at the ACLU?
It's been my push for years. It's been my push ever since I got into organizing, that, you know, like that is as a sex worker, you know, that I would never say that I'm a former anything, because you just never know. And I'm just off the market. But I would never downgrade it. I would never be ashamed of it, even in my role at the ACLU, to talk about it, because when you hired me, you hired all of me. And so that's a part of my life. I have no shame around it. My mother knows I've done it. I've had conversations with my sisters and my friends. There's no shame around it for me. And so I'm really comfortable in what I am. And it has taught me a lot about myself. It has taught me a lot about and made me who the woman that I am today. It's taught me about safety. It's taught me about economics, how to save money, how to make money, how to network. It's taught me a lot, how to graphic design. I've learned a lot as well from doing sex work. And so when I came to ACLU, they wanted me to think about what are the things that are pertinent to us. It was in the Trump administration. I was talking about what are the issues of our community. At that time, it was safety. Trans women were getting killed left and right, like it was no one's business during the Trump administration. We couldn't go in schools. We couldn't go in spaces. We couldn't be in the military. Immigration camps, it was horrible at that time. So what I needed to do, we needed to have access to IDs. We need to get into these prison systems and worry about the conditions of incarceration for my folks. And we need to decriminalize sex work. Those were the goals. And now that we have Biden, we have to further push on those things, because now is the time.
Outside of the obvious risk of arrest, how else does criminalization hurt sex workers?
If they were ever in harm's way, right? You're not going to go to those protective systems to ask for help, because you're criminalizing yourself at the same time.
So just like with undocumented people,
correct? Like
you want to get medical services. You want there's nothing you can do.
Right, the same way.
Well, I think, you know, it was funny. I was thinking about the fact that you hear all these stories about serial killers, people who kill for decades, and like, how on earth wasn't there a greater case? How come it took so long? And then you realize they focused on killing sex workers. And they knew that by killing sex workers, they would get away with it because no one would really look. No one would search. The media wouldn't cover it. The law enforcement wouldn't make a connection. They would just say, well, of course, they were sex workers.
Like a trans woman of color. Like a trans woman of color.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
Very much that. Like a trans woman of color. So I identify really well with the sex worker. There's a good alignment in there for me.
Right, and it feels like that is part of the risk of criminalization, because once you make something criminalized and turned to such a taboo, the life of the person who is engaging in it no longer counts. So
right.
You can have hundreds upon hundreds of women or trans people being murdered. Nothing's going to happen because they've been devalued.
Right. That's just something so wrong. Like, it is a life. I've never in my life ever, when someone has been brutally taken, whoever it was, never used their vices in their life, their struggles in their life, to be a judgment for me not to have enough compassion to be like, that is wrong. That's what disturbs me, is that because I am a Black trans woman and I'm a Black trans woman and a sex worker, to the rest of the world, my life ain't That's what I live with every day. And I hold that on my shoulders because I have all my friends who are not blessed to be at an ACLU like me right now. Mm. My community is hurting. That's how it feels every day. And I wear that on my shoulders, and I'm trying to get people to understand. And we're having this beautiful conversation right now, but I bet you people still are not going to receive it and get it. Someone would still respond and say, well, if they weren't doing sex work, or if I wasn't trans. Mm. So it's still that piece of you trying to tell me what I'm supposed to be for me not to be harmed, or for me to be respected. And I don't do that to you.
Mm-hmm.
What I do and how I choose to live my life bothers you that much that you make it your life's end to make me live in a living hell.
And then I think we sort of, this connects to those murders in Atlanta, where then the culture or white supremacy provides an excuse for the white man who killed those
exactly
people. And I don't know that we even know necessarily if those women were sex workers or what their level of engagement was there, but it makes that the story, because quote unquote Asian massage parlors are places where sex work happens. Then that was his issue, and and we have to now look at his addiction as opposed to, these are humans who had families who were killed, and he was encouraged to do that through a culture of anti-Asian hate that was propagated by white supremacy, but also the ex-president of this country.
I always say, after the people had stormed the Capitol like that, and nothing really got done like that, that let me know now. So I'm not really surprised about anything else, but I'm more surprised about how we respond to it, because we should know better.
It's funny. Earlier you said the thing about, like, people are afraid of this conversation or uncomfortable about the conversation. And I would like to try to disagree with you, except, in conversations around sex. And I'd like to try to disagree with you, except then Lil Nas X dropped his video recently, which proved every point you just made.
Yep.
And I'm sort of on Twitter, like, really shocked at how many people are freaking out about a music video who are like, wait, you're like a grown-up adult? But it just proves your point that people not only get charged about it, but like to get charged about being upset about it, and like to prove that they're upset about it, and like to think that this video is now going to destroy the American fabric. And I was like, I'm old enough to remember Madonna that Wicked Game video, the Two Live Crew. Right. I've been through a lot of culture destroying videos, and the culture seemed to remain.
My thing is this: if it only takes one person to destroy everything, then this thing would have been destroyed a long time ago. I'm just going to let you know that. That makes no sense. I never bought into that anger. That is something within yourself, because that video is triggering you to see your real reality of who you are. And so instead of you embracing it, you're going to shame it because you've been conditioned to shame it because white supremacy told you it was wrong. But yet we all participate in it. What makes you so uncomfortable? What is really raveling you? It's not that it's going to ruin the society or the fracture of that, because no one can control that. It's something within yourself that sparked you to now be uncomfortable with it. And you don't want to address that feeling. So you're going to reject it because that's the common thing to do.
One thing that you've said a few times in the interview is, we all take part in it.
Correct.
And I'm sure there's going to be people who are like, well, I don't really take part in it. This is not. Can you explain what you mean when you say we all take part in it?
Sex is something that we all take part in. That's what I mean. We all do.
That is true.
If we're honest with ourselves, and a lot of us won't be honest because some of us don't want us to know how sexual we really are. And so then you go there. So if you go to a strip club, you're getting a lap dance.
Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Watching porn.
You're going to the booth. Yeah. You put your little slide in and watching the girl. Like, we all partake in it in different ways. We do. If we're honest with ourselves, we all partake in it in different ways.
And so in a way, it's like our shame is killing people.
Yes, really. Yes. Our uncomfortableness and our shame. Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about FOSTA SESTA? I know Congress passed it, and in 2018, it's called the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act and the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act. You know, the claim was it was promoted to curb human trafficking online. It got bipartisan support, but it actually made the lives of sex workers, you know, even more vulnerable. It made sex work even more dangerous. Can you explain what it ended up doing?
It took away online platforms like Backpage and Craigslist and even Rent Boy, you know, for the gay community. I had Rent Boy. It stopped online platforms because there was so much trafficking going on, which to me makes no sense. If you can online track somebody and you can follow and feel safer that way and you take it away, I think more trafficking is going to happen. So I would like to actually see some kind of survey being done. Since you passed this, is it safer? Is the trafficking lower?
So it throws like all sex workers, people getting trafficked and people choosing to do sex work, all into the same group. It makes no distinction.
Yes. Now everyone is like back into like either like street-based sex work, or if you have another low clientele list or something like that, you cannot like post ads anymore like you used to. You know, like you can post an ad, say, hey, I'm in this city and this is what, you know, you can't do that anymore. That has been blocked.
I mean, it seems obvious that it would be more dangerous to eliminate online, just because, I mean, think about why people like Uber and Lyft. In addition to the convenience, the claim is that, well, I can see who's there.
Correct.
And I can do some checkup and I there's some accountability because I can see them. Yet when it comes to sex work, people don't see the same. It seems like it's a very similar kind of logic.
I would agree with you. And that's why you're going to be my new friend. See?
Yeah.
I have a new friend on the movement. Okay.
Yeah.
I only came on here. See, look, that fast. So if you can do it, they can do it.
Well, to be fair, I started with saying it was an honor. So I was already on your good side.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
I mean, I think a part of this too isn't the fact that like I look at like the legalized marijuana thing where it's like it was illegal. People are being thrown in prison for life for nonviolent drug offenses. It's awful. It's awful. It's awful. Okay, the culture shifted. It's legal, but now the money is being made by people who already have the money to make the money. Your dealer who was at the corner who was selling it to you in nickel bags cannot invest in becoming a marijuana salesman now. And the same thing, I feel like, I'm sure there's that fear with sex work that's like,
the minute it becomes legal,
suddenly there's going to be an app, then there's going to be, you know, when I heard Uber, I was like, I don't know if we want that, because that is not.
That's my fear too, in a way. That's my fear too, you know, but that's what a lot of the larger movement wants. And so I, you know, lean towards what my people want. You know, of course, I would like it not to even be a conversation.
Yeah,
you know, because it just shouldn't. Like I said, we all participate, but it should just. We have other. I think also we have other things to build and work on and do right now.
Like what?
Racism. We got to let's tackle that one first. Let's go. Let's tackle that first.
Yeah.
And then while we're tackling that, let's circle back around. You know, and have that conversation to protect those trans youth, because what y'all doing to them is horrible. Those are kids. I know how it is to be a trans kid. I was once one. And I'm 42 today. I had no childhood because I was forced to be an adult because of what these kids are going through. So no one can tell me that what they're doing is right. I lived it. I am a trans. I was once a trans teen. My life was horrible. Thank God I am where I'm at today. It's a blessing. But my childhood was horrible. No kid should have to endure what I have endured. So let's do that first. Sex work, that's not important right now. Let's work on that.
I mean, is another one of the issues with as far as sex work being illegal, as we keep talking about it. I know we will work on the other things, but to connect it back to this, is I think about like that Robert Kraft, the billionaire who owns the New York Patriots, who gets busted in New York for having some sex work done on him. I don't know what the problem was in I think it was in Florida,
right?
And he walked away with no, you know, I think the charges were thrown out or no criminal record. But that doesn't in any way talk about the harm that comes to the women who were involved in the sex work. That, like, right. Once again, people, the white men with money or people with money or people with profile
I'm so glad you said it and I didn't have to say it tonight. Thank you. Could you repeat that one more time?
Which part? You repeat the part I said so I know what to say.
Oh, no, I'm good.
But the idea that, like, white men with money, people with there money, people with profile. That they can get away with quote unquote breaking the law.
Correct.
But the people who suffer from those broken laws are the women who are doing the work and don't have the ability, don't have the money or the profile to defend themselves.
It's always been about that though. Yeah. There's always some scandal that gets caught and they get away with it, but the people who engage in it get punished. It's been going on for years, centuries.
What do you want people to know? Because I think, like you said, I can feel your sensitivity to people who are checking into this conversation for the first time, who maybe want to talk about it or know that it's a thing that we should decriminalize sex work, but they don't know how to get to it. What do you want those people to know? Or people who are suspicious of it, mm-hmm. What would you like to say to those people?
Shouldn't every person just have agency over their own body? Shouldn't everyone just have that agency to say, this is what I want to do with my body, and if this is my profession? Even if it's not your jam or not your thing, can't you just respect that person's right? It has to be some part of you that has felt that way when people try to have agency over you. And that doesn't feel well. And then also that trafficking, we all with that. We want it to stop. Of course, we're not trying to do this so that can increase. That was never the goal. That was never the plan. And that's not the movement. Of course, we don't want no part of that. And also, if we're going to talk about bringing down the folks who are engaging in that, we also have to look at the people who are also participating by purchasing it as well. If it's going to be looked at down upon because of me, because you have a big old wallet, no, it should look the same. I want you to fill it in the same ways that I should have to fill it and endure it.
What can people listening to this do? How would you? I know you work for the ACLU. The ACLU doesn't believe in people just reading and learning and having better conversations. They want to activate people to do the work. So, what can people listening here do?
One of the things I challenge you to do is to go over to ACLU's website and go check out our research brief that we did on sex work. You get all the information you need right there. You get your definitions. You get what we mean when we say decriminalize sex work. You'll get some stories and narratives from actual sex workers to give you a better understanding. You'll hear all those things in a beautiful research brief that I was able to be a part of with the amazing folks at Digital at ACLU National. Shout out to them. You can check that out and read my blogs, listen to my podcast, and also donate. And when you see anything about sex work, share it, boot it up, and have this conversation with your friends in your life. Change the culture and the shame around this conversation.
I have one last question.
Sure.
That hopefully can be kind of a fun question. We talk a lot about representation in this podcast, how people are represented. Based on all you've seen in depictions of film and television, what is the best depiction of sex workers you've ever seen, and what are the worst depictions?
Do we have time for the worst? That probably isn't going for a while.
I mean, the worst is like all the typical ones that are like in like Law and Order, those little typical shows. Like all
that was her show for a while.
Yeah, it was like, and then it's like some people, it has that pretty woman fantasy. So like that gay, that just not. But it was a nice movie, but love you, Julia Roberts, but no, that's not. It doesn't come out that way. Some people are there.
Not a documentary.
Also, as far as I think trans depiction, I would say Pose has done a little narratives around that. But also, it's a show on HBO Max I just started watching.
Veneno?
Yeah, Veneno. Yeah. It's a really, really good show. It's like a following a trans Latina girl. It's like a documentary movie slash thing, but she's like a trans Latina sex worker.
It's just disappointing. Like, there's so many negative, but is there a positive one? Yes, one.
And it's new. And it's brand new.
I mean, because I think it's because of the way the trans narrative has evolved in Hollywood. So I think now is a space to do that. So of course, for me to share something, I would have to share something that was like really my own like experience. So you ask me depictions of, I'm not just talking about sex workers. I have to look at myself. The trans sex workers ones, those have been the narratives. Veneno and Post has actually created so you can see a story. It's different. So for me, I would have to give honor to those two things.
Does that make you feel hopeful? Like the fact that like there's media that like that exists that could influence a generation to view whether it's sex work or trans people in a completely different way.
It's not even about being just hopeful. I'm just like really just in the moment. You know, I'm like trying to like really feel it and experience it because it's like still shocking to me in a way, like some of how far a lot of things have come. Mm. And so when you ask me that question, it's heavy for me because I have not really thought about that. I want to be deep about the answer though, but that's a good, good question to ask me. I've not allowed myself to feel, but I'm going to get back to you. That's a really good question.
Thank you. I'm glad we're friends now.
I know, me too.
Yeah, me too.
Yes. Well,
thank you so much for being on our podcast today. Thank you for the resources and the knowledge. We appreciate you being on.
Anytime.
And thank you for inviting us to the conversation. Even though we booked you on our podcast, I do feel like you also then invited us to have the conversation on our podcast. We appreciate that.
Yes. I think anything you do in life, you know, anytime I do anything, I like to like, let's set the intentions from the beginning because people can come in there uncomfortable. Everybody's on edge. We don't know each other. Just, I want like, let's just enter this conversation human to human and hear each other out. Even if you disagree with me, at least I can say y'all heard me out.
Well, I agree with you. So I'll say that. I don't know about Hari, but I agree with you.
I agree. That was implied.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. Thank you.
Lala Holston-Zanell is Trans Justice Campaign Manager at the ACLU.
To learn more about the case for decriminalizing sex work and to see policy recommendations for making the lives of sex workers safer, visit ACLU.org/sexwork. That's ACLU.org/sexwork.
Coming up, it's my pal, Broad City's Ilana Glazer. Ilana Glazer is a writer, actress, and comedian who, along with Abby Jacobson, got everyone's attention as the co-star and co-creator of Broad City.
In 2020, her Horny for the Polls tour promoted voter education and participation, as did her web series Cheat Sheet for the Voting Booth.
She's got a new movie coming out on Hulu in June called False Positive. It's a horror thriller satire about fertility treatment.
Time to talk to Ilana.
Well, no, I'm really happy that you're here, Ilana. So thanks for joining us. Like it's like exciting because we have talked about it for a long time, and also you're even busier now because you're about to have a baby.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have this
congratulations.
Baby. You both have children, yes?
I have one, 7 month old, and Kamau
gorgeous
has more.
Little baby.
Yeah.
Your kids are a little older, right, Kamau?
Yeah, I have three daughters, a 9-year-old, wow. a 6-year-old, and a 2.5-year-old.
Wow.
Yeah.
My God, three girls. That's amazing. Is that powerful? And Hari, your baby's a boy, right?
As of now, yes.
As of now.
Until she tells me otherwise, yes.
Yeah, his sex is male. He's so I couldn't tell from the like single drop drooling picture where he's looking at you. He's so cute.
I actually reached out to my agent after getting all this positive feedback on Instagram about my child and asked her, do you know any baby modeling agents?
Hell yeah, man.
Connected with Gerber or Baby Bjorn.
No.
Dog, before it's conscious, get that money in.
Correct.
I'm about it. I'm into it.
And then what I was told was not to pimp my child. And I said, that's not what I'm doing.
It's really
I'm
wrong.
Supporting
it's
the
really
dreams
wrong.
My child doesn't know they have yet.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I don't blame you. I mean, it is totally gnarly, but I'm like, oh, if it was three things and it happened within a year or two and then you pretended it never happened to the kid.
Well, I mean, for as a parent of mixed race daughters and seeing all the commercials that are like feature the mixed race daughters, I know it's an option for me. But I'd like to keep it firmly in the back pocket. If eventually show business tells me the truth and that I'm done, then I'll be like, all right, well, I got these three mixed race daughters. What do you need? Gap?
Yeah.
What do you need?
What are we talking here?
We need Cheerios commercial. What do we need? What do you need? Yeah. Cute kid looking at a spill that the dad made in the kitchen. I got it all.
Yeah. Yep. Deep in that back pocket.
You're in New York, so you really need to be thinking about also like college for your kid. Like you need to think about like the best preschool that will track that kid through Oxford. Yeah.
I love my little spot in Brooklyn. I've been thinking about like what's the next step, and I don't know. I grew up on Long Island in the suburbs of Suffolk County, and that culture is really frightening, full of
I'm
terror.
From Queens, so I know you're right.
Yes, your cops were my high school peers.
Correct.
They're horrible, man. I'm holding Long Island in my mind so much more these days. Just Suffolk County is, you know, whatever. But I wouldn't want to go back there. But I am thinking like something up above the city, getting a little more room. I can't really wrap my head around the school system here and how much there is to navigate. It's like, I'm just not a researcher. And I went to public school and I'm like, don't you just go to the zip codes school and then you learn about the socioeconomic status of where you grew up that way? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. How much of like growing up in Long Island in public schools there affected how you see the world and what you're doing now?
I mean, it's everything. You know, I did like gymnastics and dance and Hebrew school and shit, but like that's so much of a kid's life. I went to high school with 3,000 kids. I was cattle in high school, primarily white, you know, by design, Italian American, Irish American, and then just like whatever random Anglo-Aryan white people. And, you know, I was not like a visible minority as a white person, but like Jews are a minority where I grew up. And there were some Black and Asian people and Latinx people, but it was like, if it's designed that way, like from the outside in, then the culture of the town mimics that. It's like, I graduated in 2005. It's not really like it was like Saved by the Bell, like hot jocks versus nerds. You know, it was like, I was like nerdy and a good kid, me and my best friends, but we weren't like, I mean, my gay friends were bullied, but we weren't like totally bullied group, except for my one friend in particular, who was more like present, like visibly gay. But it was everything. It was everything. That, my school, and also I waitressed at this like tiny diner for 4 years from 14 to 18. And that really made me realize how loaded with mafia my town is and how they are in business with the police. Yeah, but that's my whole view. That's kind of why I'm like, public school is so important. It's like, it's a different kind of education than when I hear about such a thoughtful education in private school.
Well, that always felt funny because I remember going to college up in Maine, growing up in New York, and these kids knew how to write these incredible research papers, and they like had lived on their own for years. And then afterwards,
so,
you know,
weird.
Right. And I think about it, I'm like, but you don't know how to talk to minorities?
Yeah.
That weirds you out. You read about us, but you don't know how to talk to us. That's the thing you didn't learn. And
weird.
It makes sense because they're all like, all these places are looking for diversity, and it's a commodity. Diversity is a commodity, and it's something that I don't think I ever realized growing up in such a diverse place, that we actually had something that is commodified. Like the,
right.
like the idea of knowing how to interact with other human beings in a globalizing world is something to be valued, and I don't think we were taught that, and it's certainly how I see the world, and I'm sure it obviously impacts how you do as well.
And when you say commodified, it makes me think, oh God, folded into the like into capitalism in this like enslaving way. But then also what you're talking about is like a new currency, like a human currency beyond like societal dictation currency, that's like invaluable because it's human.
Let's talk about your new movie that's coming out on Hulu. I'm trying to be the Terry Gross here and make sure that
that
your publicist is like, did they talk about the movie? So like, it also it is very connected to who you are and also your work and working in reproductive health for women's reproductive health. So you know, your standard horror thriller about women's fertility treatments. how did that come to be?
It's very chill, isn't it? So False Positive is a thriller that I wrote with John Lee, who directed it, and I starred in it. And the horror of the movie is how the patriarchy is expressed through medicine, expressed like even more amplified through pregnancy medicine, even more amplified through IVF, which appears to be an extremely difficult and sad process. Just like you have to just do so much procedural shit around getting pregnant. It just seems, and I'm not saying it's only sad and I don't know, but it just seems like really hard. And it's like such an amplified version of how the medical system fucks over female bodies or non-male bodies.
There's a way to do it where it would be a drama, you know, maybe a dramedy since you're a comedian, you know, since you're a comedian.
Right.
But horror thriller is such a specific take on that. How did it end up in that as a horror thriller?
I guess the genre itself is a bit of the joke to us. That is the comedic lens for this project. John is one of the co-creators of Wondershowsen. Do you guys know or remember Wondershowsen?
Of course, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Just so wacky and political and so pointedly and intentionally. And, you know, also like my character, Lucy, she's not like this queer Jew like me. She's like a New York City white lady. And she's in this relationship with Justin Theroux, plays my husband. And it's like, you know, on screen, you see like age differences between female actors and male actors. And you're supposed to be like, yeah, 15 years difference, 15 years younger. That's so she's worth it. She's worth it for him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, I think that is what was like funny to us in a way, you know, where it's like me playing this type of person. And there's so many, it was so weird. Like once we started making the film, like we saw so many Lucys. You could look and see Lucy like around the city so much. I guess after Broad City and my stand up, it's like, I'm like so hyper conscious and like continually, I mean, just personally and privately, continually trying to raise my consciousness, not just about like the world and sociopolitical, but like truly inside. And I think that in contrast to have this character who has taken the scripts that we're all sort of fed for granted was funny for us. Like, imagine me playing this character, you know, that was like, it was like comedy. So we would call these like horror or thriller moments like jokes, but they're not really jokes. It's pretty scary. I mean, it's a creepy, scary movie, and it's not, you're not laughing really, but it is funny, you know, in that surprise, like in what makes a joke, like the surprise, the twist. And so we were writing it as comedians, but the genre itself was comical to us to operate within for this kind of story.
You said something interesting there about becoming more politicized as a result of Broad City and your stand-up. What do you mean by that? Like, that was the impetus to get you more thought? Was it like because of the criticism of Broad City and taking it to heart? Or what was it that opened your mind with those two shows?
It's more that I had the privilege to make what was internal, external, and to get enough eyes on it, or people gave a shit enough to write about it. And it's not like the criticism really made me think about ... It's more just the actual process of being able to put something out there, having it spoken about, and thinking about it. You know, when we even just started the web series, we did not think it was feminist at all. Because you know how you just move through this world of the person that you are. And we were like, huh. And that was also Amy Poehler's. I remember when she talked about the sexual politic of Broad City to us, just casually. And I'm like, what are we talking about? Where I'm like, I just didn't even, you know, it's like the process of making Broad City and putting it out raised my consciousness. So then I could reach further. And then also it's like 50 fucking episodes. I can't even believe it. The further I get from it, the more it becomes this finite experience. So each season, it's like the experience of making it and putting it out got me vertical in being able to see, look around. And then my reach in raising my own consciousness got wider. And then another experience, you know, season 3. And so just that experience of seeing it air and being like, this is out there. People are receiving this. I don't know. Basic existence stuff is what I think raised my political consciousness.
Isn't there a way that, like, I feel like this is, as a Jewish white presenting woman, you have to deal with a level of criticism as a, you know, South Asian dude from someplace called Queens has to deal with a level of criticism, black man in America, that we have to take the criticism in, or even the accolades. Like, somebody may say something about your show that is nice, but you're like, oh, is that what it is? I have to do that now? You know what I mean?
100%.
In a way that, like, your average white comic can just sort of like, good, bad, indifferent, you know, like, not have to sort of like reckon with.
Yeah. But even white males who are like, what does that mean? You know, if you're tuned into the idea of like really taking something in.
If you're tuned in, that's the key. That I think there's with a white male comic, there's the option of tuning in or not. I think
that's
in a
right.
way that like
that's right.
I don't know that you get to like choose. You know, no, I see that feedback or that criticism. We're not dealing with it.
Absolutely, and that's so true. Like criticisms and accolades reached my heart equally. It's not like this is not my mother telling me she loves me or not. You know what I mean? This is just somebody I don't fucking know. And it just is bizarre to be reflected by strangers. Bizarre, whether it's positive or negative.
That's one thing I loved, actually, the fact that, you know, there was a lot of stuff online just about cultural appropriation and Broad City's coming off the heels of Girls, too. And Girls was so extremely polarizing and had so much criticism. So, like, maybe undeservedly, like, you're also getting, I felt like, some of what, you know, HBO's Girls was getting was thrown on you before you said a word. And then, you know, what is seen as appropriation. What I loved about Broad City is how you addressed it in the show. Like, you would call yourselves out within the show for doing it, which I found really realistic in a way, because you can either not appropriate at all, which is not honest, because white people do that shit all the time, regardless of how thoughtful they are. Or you can, you know, do it and not give a shit what people have to say. And it felt like you found a middle ground in the show where I'm going to say these things and then I will get called out for it. How intentional was that? Was that something that the writers were thinking of? Is that something you and Abby thought about with Broad City? Like, these are legitimate criticisms. How do we talk about it, make it funny, and be true to the characters?
Like, you're just reminding me, I was in the middle of a tour when the lockdown happened. But I was doing this whole bit about Yas Queen.
Hold up, wait a minute.
Yas, or Yas Queen, is something that some people say in response to something fabulous. You could be fiercely celebrating someone for what they're doing, how they're looking, what they've said. But the important thing is to know where it came from.
It first got popularized in 2013 when this video of a fan loving Lady Gaga went viral.
Yes! Yes, Gaga, you look so good. Oh my God, yes! Gaga, you look beautiful!
And then when Alana and Abby started using it on Broad City, it got really huge.
Again, Yas Queen!
Yas Queen!
Yas!
Yas!
Yas, yas, yas!
Yas, yas, yas!
Everyday people and think piece writers started asking, hey, where did this come from?
And as always, when you ask where a piece of pop culture comes from, the answer is usually black people and often 1980s queer people of color culture, like the New York City ball culture documented in the film Paris is Burning.
And those balls, Yas, is that right? Am I saying it right?
No.
Yas, no?
No.
Was used to encourage the performers. And this usage of the term continues to this day in shows like RuPaul's Drag Race.
Oh, yes!
Wow!
Yes! You know what else continues?
Yas Queen!
Cultural appropriation.
Mm.
The more you know.
So say what you're going to say, but know where you got it from and give credit.
Oh my God, the way white women can say something and people are like, oh my God, did you make that up? And it's like explosive, you know what I mean? And I had this whole bit of like, what scale of Dolezal am I, you know? And she like perms her hair. I wake up like this, but like, you know, and from Madonna to whoever to whatever. Once Broad City ended, to have the foresight enough to be like, that was fucking crazy. That was like our sort of biggest cultural, what is it? Not bellwether, but the lightning rod or something.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't even know, you know what I mean? We didn't know that we were appropriating it. It was, you know, it wasn't like we weren't quite aware of it. And, but then to see it reflected so loudly and largely, and then it was like, yes, this comes from drag culture. You know, Abby and I like show around the show. So we wrote not every episode, other people wrote the episodes, but we rewrote every episode. I mean, we were synonymous with like we were the writers, you know, and had a writer's room. But I think it was just this process of specifically like I wore these like Latina earrings
And we're like, that's funny. I'm not Latina. And then it was like, then we see it on TV and we're like, yeah, that's incorrect. That's incorrect. And then we're like, well, it's funny that it's incorrect because we're fucking white knuckleheads. What the fuck? And so then we go back and we were lucky enough to have more episodes to be like, you know, Jaime is like, don't wear Latina earrings. And I'm like, I am so sorry. And I'm like also appropriating Grindr by just being on it. You know, so it's like, it's really this privilege of having all that runway. We didn't know we were going to have that runway season one. So we wrote it as though it could end. We didn't know in season two that we'd have season three. So it's like, I think that also speaks to the drive from inside to raise the consciousness and reflect it in the canvas that is available at that moment, because you just never know, I think, with art. Oh, will I get to like build this tour and have all these different audiences? You don't even know, you know, it's like you could be hot one year and not the next and whatever. So it's like kind of important, I think, to like reach out as far as you can within yourself.
I think it's really fascinating how you work politics into your life and find ways to reach younger audiences with it, whether that's Generator Collective or Horny for the Polls. You know, I'd love to hear more about both, but, you know, I think it's interesting with Generator Collective. The goal is to humanize policy through people-powered stories on Instagram and thus lower the barrier to people using their platforms to enter the conversation. We define minimum civic engagement. So I guess my questions, first of all, is what do you mean by lowering the barrier for people to use their platforms to enter the conversation? And also, how do you define minimal civic engagement?
There is such a high barrier of entry to understanding politics. I really feel like you have to grow up in DC with parents who are politicians to have a baseline structural understanding of what policy is and how it gets made. Kind of like in Hollywood, it's obviously so much easier for children of professional actors and musicians to enter the business because they have this feeling of access to the system. It's the same thing with politics, and they keep it seeming like this brilliant academic thing so that, you know, the minority can control the power. So for us, what we want to do is remove the shame of not understanding the system, which I'm like happy to do and happy to step in and represent because it's funny. You know what I mean? As comedians, I'm like, it's pretty funny that I like really, it's just, it's funny.
It's funny that you don't know.
Yeah. I'm a full grown adult. I've found success. I have resources, and yet it's really, really hard for me to know when the elections are. The New York City mayoral election, I'm like, there are so many candidates, and I know Andrew Yang's name, but that doesn't mean that he's the person to vote for just because I know his name. I know his name because he ran for president. I mean, it's also sad, but isn't comedy both comedy and tragedy? So it just is like genuinely deeply funny to me. And the other thing I wanted to just say is like, you know, I have this experience that we spoke to about like having a platform and what a privilege it is, I feel, to have a space, to have a voice, and then to feel seen and heard. But the thing is, these days, everyone has a platform. Everyone has, I mean, unless they like really aren't on social media, but like pretty much everyone has a profile. Like, can you imagine in the 90s being like, can I see your profile? And it's like, what? But everyone now has this page or pages. Everyone has a platform.
Can you describe, because I think for people who don't know Generator Collective, like specifically what it does, I think that was a good thing. The way you put it makes sense, but just what the goal is.
So Generator is a collective of a few, at this point, three branches. The first is these two camera videos on Instagram stories. Everyone has a voice. Everyone has access to a platform. You know, our thing is say your name, location, one thing you love just for fun, state your issue. Your issue can be fucking anything. We promise we'll find what policy it is. Tag Generator, we repost you and hashtag the policy. If you're just like, I don't know if this matters, but my bus is always on time because I'm like following it online, but it's always so packed, I can't even step on. You tag Generator, we'd repost you and be like, city budget at Mayor de Blasio or whatever. And it's like, oh, this is about budget. So we humanize policy in real time in that way. At this point, minimal civic engagement to us is vote in every election.
know every election that's going on and vote in every one. And we, you know, do you guys know Indivisible?
Yes. Oh, of course. Yes.
Yeah.
So like our thing is also like, you know, I cheated a lot in high school. I was like, I just don't know fucking French. And our friend Maya was like, you know, lucky enough to go to France every summer. Maya knew French well. So can you just let us know what the answers are? And she would. We were like, Maya, you know what I mean? And we're like getting the answers. And it's like, I did the same with Indivisible, where I have my, like, my Indivisible on my block, Liat. And I'm like, Liat, who are you voting for? What's the deal with this thing? Do you know a protest to go to this week? Just everyone should know Indivisible and know that that resource is there. It also feels good to know that there's a grassroots network of people in the progressive movement all over. When I think about our country, I'm like, racist, misogynist, transphobia. You feel that really hard, but to feel this entire complex network of people working on the progressive movement day in and day out choicefully, it gives a different feel to life. The second thing with generators, generator lives, these like roundtable discussions that I've had with really fucking awesome people, just amazing people. Gloria Steinem, Amanda Nguyen, Eric Holder, Jumaane Williams, Cynthia Nixon when she was running, Zephyr Teachout when she was running for Attorney General of New York, where I talk to activists and politicians and see how one hinges from the other in an ideal world. And then the third branch is Jenny Socials. Jenny Socials are dance parties that you dance for 15 to 20 minutes. And then we like stop and take a break. And a politician or activist comes up and gives a cheat sheet for the upcoming election.
Wow.
Again, we have an Indivisible up and we're like, why is this prop, this ballot proposal double negative? What is the answer? And you just write California. The fucking answer.
That's where California comes in.
Oh my God, California. It's like, you're like transparently trying to trick me and it's fucking rude, you know?
And I still don't understand. I know you're trying to trick me, but I still don't know the answer.
Yeah, I know something fishy's going on, but yeah. I went to public school, so I can't really hold the sentence by the time I get to the end to understand what I'm supposed to say.
Or I'm just a busy person who's got a lot going on and wants to know what the right thing to do here. And you're clearly, like you said, by the time I get to the end of the sentence, I don't remember what the beginning was. Because I'm also just a person who's like, just ask me a direct question. And these propositions are written to not ask you a direct question.
You know it's evil because you're shrouding it in triple negative nonsense. Fuck you. Do not trick me. Be the evil shithead that you are. Fine. Yeah. And then... like suffer the consequences. And if you don't want to be in politics, go make your money in advertising or whatever the fuck. Oof. You know, it's like, I just hate that shit with these, like, you know, when the Texas snowstorm happened and it's like, why are you politicians? Why don't you just work for the oil companies? So such that when all this climate crisis shit happens, you're making the money that, you know, doesn't bother you to make in the evil ways that you made it. But why are you like, pretending to be in public service, you're not. And then for Horny for the Polls, it makes me laugh now that that was the name of the tour. Every city I went to, I'd stay an extra night and throw a Jenny Social there. So at the stand-up shows, you could register to vote with headcount. And then it's like, can you not make it to the comedy show? Come dance. You want to hang two nights in a row, see a comedy show, we'll dance, and you'll learn about your upcoming election.
Because a lot of the tour dates ended up getting canceled because of COVID, right?
Yes.
So then what did, but you were still kind of pushing Horny for the Polls even after.
Yeah.
I've never said horny this much in any forum. it doesn't go with my prudish demeanor, but you kept it going. What was the thinking by keeping it going? And I know you also posted stuff for Horny for the Polls.
After COVID shut down two-thirds of this Horny for the Polls tour, we were like, how do we keep the message going? You know, we were going to do it in March and then like September, October, where it was more about in-person reach, where you could come to comedy shows, sign up to Canvas that weekend. But then when that shut down, we were like, how do we digitally safely reach everybody? Was this cheat sheet series that we did. I had such amazing guests who generously lent their platform to say, vote for Biden. A lot of people want to be like, vote and take a cute pic. And it's like, but not for, like, this time, not for Trump, right? You know, and it's like, are you down to
lose that Trump money? I don't even know. I'm like, who? Please just say for Biden this time. And we made the space to like hold that people weren't stoked. Like, you know, our phrase was like, I'm not stoked, but I'm down. You gotta be. We gotta go.
It's like this such an honest way of doing something that was incredibly difficult to do, to get people excited about Joe Biden. I love that. Like, I'm not stoked, but I'm down. Like, all right, I'll go with this. I'll go along. Yeah. I'll go along with plan B or C right now. Sure.
Yeah, and it's like, even still, it's like, I'm not like the Democratic Party. I'm stoked about the progressive movement that's happening within the Democratic Party. And these people are playing the game to win the game, and I'm here for it. You know, so there's excitement now, but like that tenor of that time was so awful. So that was like our thing at that time. And so Horny for the Polls, we took that concept and just like your thottiest, sexiest fucking picture, post it, do hashtag Horny for the Polls. And I actually even forget what info we did. Just say like vote for Biden, tag Biden. And it's like funny to tag Biden in like bikini, thotty bikini pics. Like I don't even know what, I forget like what information we were trying to convey. But it was mostly just like get excited and vote for Biden.
I was going to send a thotty which I looked up and I know what it means now. I was going to send my thottiest pick, but the we were having a baby and all, so I didn't get around to the... Just too much was happening.
Your body was different. Your body was changed.
Yes. I put on a lot of sympathy weight, Alana. You have to understand.
Yes.
Oh my God, your partner's so lucky.
Alana, thank you so much for being on Politically Reactive. Before we go, I have to tell you something I hadn't told you. So remember when my brother Ashok and I were doing Punch Up for the second season of Broad City? And Punch Up is when you hire some writers to help add jokes. And it was really exciting. And we got some of our jokes on the second season, which was really great. And you thanked us in the credits, which was really exciting. But what I hadn't told you is I hadn't actually seen the show when I agreed to do it. So I had to kind of guess what kind of characters you were based on the minimal I knew about you. And it worked and it helped because there's other great writers in the room. I took like Megan Neuringer was there. Anthony, whose last name I always get wrong, who played Trump in the Trump show, who's brilliant.
Atamanek, hilarious.
Atamanek, who's brilliant. I can't remember if Naomi was there. God, she's a friend of mine.
Perigan, yeah.
And my last name's Kundabolu.
but this I had is so to, many apologies.
So many apologies. And me being such a hypocrite. I felt so bad. And I'm so excited that our jokes made it in. And
it's so cool. I actually think that that's a strength in a room of like diverse Punch-Up perspectives. That makes sense and is chill and worked correctly.
Okay, so it was okay that I was unprepared for the task.
Totally.
And so,
okay, I don't know that that's unprepared. I think you authentically came forth and it clearly
worked. I was so authentic about that. Yeah.
Maybe you shouldn't have been wearing all the Broad City merchandise and gear and kept talking about, I'm such a big fan of the show and I know all the episodes backwards and forwards and leading the trivia nights. Maybe that was the part where you
I love Hannibal's character. Right. What's his name on the show?
Exactly.
Oh, Hannibal? Oh, all right.
Yeah, I love the IMDb page I read on the way here. Yes.
Yeah.
But Joss and I, when we were, you know, having the baby, she did most of the work, but we did watch lots of Broad City. I've caught up. She loves both of you. She loves the show. And we were sad to see it go. And and I just want to say, you know, thank you for making that wonderful show and letting me and my brother be a part of it, even in the smallest way.
A pleasure to have you both. And thank you for watching it. Finally, Jesus Christ.
I got to it.
I like when people haven't watched it because I'm like, oh, you're going to have fun. So that's like lovely. I'm like, go have fun. Go hang.
Alana Glazer is a writer, actress, and comedian. Check out her storytelling and activism platform, Generator Collective, at generatorcollective.com. That's generatorcollective.com.
You can see Alana's comedy special, The Planet is Burning, on Amazon Prime, and her new movie, False Positive, will be out on Hulu on June 25th.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Lala Holston-Zanell and Alana Glazer.
We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
Keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the hashtag PoliticallyReactive.
Or, even better than Twitter, leave us a voicemail at 1984.
Or you could not be snarky and just call 917-477-6525. Again, that's 917-477-6525.
Let the world know what you think of the show by rating and reviewing wherever you get your podcast. And if you haven't already, subscribe. By the way, if you don't like our podcast, don't rate and review it.
I mean, just lie and say you loved it.
Yeah.
Help us.
Yeah.
So as we always say, there's a lot going on in the world, but this week I want to promote something that we didn't talk about in the episode, but I want us all to pay attention to. Workers who work at Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama are fighting to unionize. If you know anything about Amazon, yes, they pay $15 an hour, but that's about the only thing they do. And often those wages actually drive down wages in the economy. So they sound good from a headline, but they're not actually as good as they sound in practice. So Amazon workers should absolutely be unionized. Many of us relied on Amazon workers during the pandemic and after. So please, if you want to keep up with that, go to @BAmazonUnion, @B, Amazon Union on Twitter, or BAmazonUnion.org. So that's B for Bessemer, BAmazonUnion.org. Because if they win it there, then Amazon workers will likely be able to get it across the country.
I second everything W. Kamau Bell has just said. And after you do that, check out our Netflix specials. Netflix. Warn Your Relatives and Private School Negro. Available on Netflix.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And my big brother, W. Kamau Bell.
And my son, Hari Kondabolu.
What?
You had to find out eventually.
No! The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger-Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music. Again, check out his book, 100 Boyfriends, or his music, his new EP that's out on Spotify or other music services. Also, thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
She leads the ACLU's advocacy and organizing work to support and empower transgender and binary people. Is it non-binary people?
Nope, she just wants to champion binary people.
Man.
It's a weird thing to want to like empower transgender people and binary people. It's weird, but it's a very specific work nobody else is doing.
What about the rights of binary people?
Okay, Josh Hawley.